dark of night, one light still yet burns. Frightened fingers tremble as brittle pages turn. Fireside Mystery Theater presents The Midnight Reading, a special summer series of dramatic recitations of dark masterpieces in miniature by the masters of the macabre. Hello, I'm Ali Silva. This episode is sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Well, you must know that it's people who make your business a success. The right people. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 job sites with just one click. ZipRecruiter is unlike other job sites. It doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. ZipRecruiter has an easy-to-use dashboard where you can screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place. You can find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And you can do it for free when you go to ZipRecruiter.com/fireside. Yeah, that's right. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/fireside, post jobs for free, and find the right talent to make your business a success. In the short story, The Adventure of the Sussex Vampire, first published by The Strand magazine in 1924, Arthur Conan Doyle's most famous creation, the detective Sherlock Holmes, makes a very brief mention in passing about the giant rat of Sumatra, a story for which the world is not yet prepared. Never again in this story, or in any of the handful of Holmes stories that followed, would Doyle ever expound upon this odd reference. In fact, this cryptic utterance seems fascinatingly out of place in Holmes's world of cold calculation, engendered by deductive reasoning. But perhaps not so out of place in the world of his creator. For Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was a fervent believer in spiritualism and was not afraid to use the powerful platform of his fame and reputation to promote the many controversial ideas and claims associated with the spiritualist movement. Although Doyle began his career as a man of science, as a physician, he later in life took part in seances, enjoyed the company of psychics, mediums, seers, and anyone who made serious claims to possess supernatural powers. In this episode, our own James Reeser is going to read for you from Doyle's final published work, a collection of paranormal experiences called The Edge of the Unknown. The following are two true personal accounts, The Ghost of the Moat and A London Ghost. Did Arthur Conan Doyle suffer from delusions brought forth by a need and a desire to believe in an existence beyond the reach of our own? Or was he truly able to approach mysteries that defy the limits of human understanding? Whatever the case may be, this much is true. An interesting story is an interesting story.
The Ghost of the Moat. If anyone craves for adventure, he will find it in psychic work. I have myself encountered many incidents in actual fact which I could hardly beat if I gave free play to my imagination. Some mention of Dr. and Mrs. Wickland of Los Angeles have occasionally found their way into the press. He is a deep student of psychic phenomena, believing, as I do myself, that a great deal of mania and crime is due to direct obsession, and that a recognition of the fact would be the first necessary step for dealing with it. She is a medium who is very sensitive to spirit presences, and is ready, with great bravery, to allow them to control her, so long as she thinks a good purpose can be served. She is, in my opinion, one of the heroines of the world. Such were the couple, gentle, elderly folk, who drove out with us to see something of rural Sussex. I took them to the old moated grange of Groombridge, which is mentioned by Evelyn in his diary. As we stood looking at the lichened brick walls, a door which gave upon the deep moat opened, and a woman looked out. Oh, then it closed again. We passed on, and I thought no more of the matter. As we walked through the meadow which led to the high road, Mrs. Wickland kept glancing back. Presently she said, "There is such a strange old man walking beside us." "What is he like?" "He is old. His face is sunk forward. His back is hunched. He's earthbound." "How is he dressed?"
He has knee breeches, a striped vest, and quite a short coat.
Whence did he come?
He came through that door that opened.
Then how did he cross the moat?
I don't know, and I don't know what he wants, but he is at our heels.
I took my guest to the old Crown Inn in the village, where we had tea. Mrs. Wickland kept glancing at a chair in the corner beside her.
He is there.
Presently she began to laugh.
I did not in the least want that second cup of tea and the extra slice, she said. But he was close to me and would have taken possession and helped himself if I had not done so.
We had driven home and were seated among the roses on my veranda, the Wicklands, my wife, and myself. We were talking of other things when the seer suddenly gave a start.
He's here.
Then came the amazing moment. Before our eyes, she changed in an instant into a heavy-faced, sullen old man, with bent back and loose senile lips. The whole expression was utterly different. She choked and spluttered in an effort to express the thoughts of the control. Dr. Wickland, with the quiet assurance of long practice, massaged the throat.
All right, friend. Give yourself time. The newcomer shook off his hand angrily.
Leave me alone! What do you want to touch me for?
He croaked. From that time, the dialogue was as follows, sometimes one and sometimes another asking the questions, and with occasional gaspings and chokings as interruption.
Who are you?
I'm from Groombridge. My name? Well, I don't feel clear in my mind. Yes, I remember. It's David Fletcher. That's it. David Fletcher. Yes, I have been in service there. Horses. Yes, it was the horses I looked to. What year is it? Yeah, I don't know. My mind ain't clear. Is it 1808 or is it 1809?
What do you say? 1927? Well, that's a good one. Ted. Why, I'm here talking to you. How can I be dead? I'd be with God if I was dead.
Look at my hand.
Why are there rings on it? They look like my lady's rings. I don't know how they came to be there.
I don't understand a lot of things.
I know who them folks are in the house. I have no call to be there. Me and the others try to put them out.
The others, Dr. Wickland explained, were probably other earthbound spirits in the old house.
Yes, Master was a good master. But he died, and the others came in. A house was sold, and we wasn't well treated after that.
What could I do? No, I couldn't go away. Where was I to go out in the wide world? Me, with a hump on my back. I belonged to the house. I had to do the best I could.
What have I done? I don't rightly understand it. I've slept always in the same old corner. It seems a long, long time.
Now tell us, David, don't you remember being very ill?
Me? Ill? No, I was never ill. But I'll tell you what happened. They pushed me into the water.
Into the moat?
Yes, into the water.
Who was he?
It was Sam. But I held on to him, I did. He came in the water too.
Dr. Wickland remarked that the man was probably drowned on that occasion.
Is there no one who loved you among the dead? Was your mother dead?
Mother was dead. No one ever loved me except Mother. She loved me, Mother did. No one could love me because I looked queer. They laughed.
Mother loved me. Nobody else. Said it wasn't right that I wait upon the ladies and me with a hump.
Cheer up, David. We will soon get that hump off you. How came you to follow us?
I don't know. I think I was told. And I got
bread and tea. I've not had tea since I can remember. I would like more. I'm always hungry. But what was that wagon? That was the devil's wagon, I think. I got in, but I went that fast that I was afeard to get out again.
This was my motor. It's as well for you that you did not, for we are going to do you good, David. First of all, you have got to realize that you are dead. You were drowned that time that you fell into the moat.
Well, I never. It's a queer idea.
Now understand this. It is Dr. Wickland who is talking in cool, gentle, assured tones. You can do anything now by the power of thought, if you know how to use it. This hump of yours, take it off. Take it off, I say. Your back is as straight as mine. The bent figure began to straighten up and to sit erect in the chair. Suddenly, both hands were thrown forward.
Mother! Mother!
His face had become younger, more intelligent, and was shining with ecstasy.
I can see her, and his mother, but she looks younger than I can remember.
She will take charge of you now. You have been brought here by higher powers for a purpose, to save you. Do you want to go back to the old house?
No, I want to go to Mother. Oh, you good, kind people.
The rest was just incoherent gratitude.
And so it was that the earthbound ostler found his mother at last among the rambler roses of my balcony. Have I not said truly that the actual experiences of the spiritualist, of which this is 1 in 100, are stranger far than what I should dare to invent? Is it all a fairy tale? How about the change in the medium? How about the ostler's dress so accurately described? How about the cases where the actual names and addresses have been verified by the Wicklands? It is not a fairy tale, but it is a new realm of knowledge, which the human race has now to explore and conquer.
A London Ghost.
For some days, the papers had contained accounts of a haunted house within a few hundred yards of Piccadilly Circus, which had aroused the interest of the public. The allegations, founded on the actual experiences of residents, were that, in the lower room of this building, there was a perceptible and evil psychic atmosphere. That raps were heard, that a luminous ray was seen on the stair, and that a figure of an elderly man with an evil face had several times been seen by a young woman who was employed professionally on the premises. It was to test this matter that a few of us assembled on the night of May 28th, 1924, reaching the house at 11 o'clock. It was in the theatre neighbourhood, and it was a curious change from the streets which were crowded with the returning pleasure-seekers to the absolute silence of the sinister old house which stands in a by-street. Our party consisted of the young woman, already quoted, whom I will call the clairvoyant, the secretary of the business, a young Dutch artist, who claimed also to have psychic vision, Mr. Horace Leaf, who was a strong medium, a Wimpole Street physician, the Reverend Vale Owen, and myself. As I had organized the expedition, I took it on myself to guard the party against practical jokers. All doors were locked, and a piece of twine was tied across the only staircase which led down to the lower room. In this lower room we assembled, and at 11:30, having grouped ourselves around a table so that we might be in a position to obtain table messages, we turned out the lights. No sound at all reached us from the street, and we sat quietly, awaiting events, chatting occasionally among ourselves, as experience has shown that sound vibrations are helpful in psychic phenomena. At first, the darkness had seemed absolute. Gradually, however, we were able to discern a dim light upon the stair. It had a spectral effect, but we were all in agreement that it was caused by a reflection from the glass roof of the building, and that it was our own vision growing gradually used to the conditions which had caused it to develop. We were not aware of any particular psychic atmosphere, and there were a few distant taps or cracks, but not more than is usual in an old house in the silence of the night time. Our hands were all on the table, which occasionally thrilled and shook, but gave no pronounced movement. We had begun to think that our results might be entirely negative, when the clairvoyant on my left whispered in an agitated voice,
"I see him. He is there. He is standing on the stair looking down at us. An elderly man, bearded with rather slit eyes and a cunning expression,"
was her description of the apparition. It was corroborated by the Dutchman. I could see the faint luminosity which marked the line of the stairs, but nothing more. I do not, however, possess any psychic perceptions. The two seers reported that the man had descended a little, and the clairvoyant showed signs of considerable emotion. We spoke, begging the unseen figure to approach us and to tell us how we could assist it. A moment later, the two seers agreed that it was no longer on the stair. In a minute, the table began to move. It rose and fell in a steady rhythm. My experience of table sittings, which is a large one, has shown me that undeveloped spirits always make violent and irregular, often circular movements, and that steady movement is a sign of a deliberate, thoughtful control. We were reassured, therefore, as regards the nature of our invisible visitant. Having explained the code, the dialogue between us ran thus. The answers coming, clear-cut and swift. "Are you a spirit?"
"Yes."
"A man?"
"Yes."
"Are you the spirit who has haunted this room?"
"Yes."
"Have you a reason for haunting it?"
"Yes."
"Is it money that troubles you?"
"No."
"Papers?"
"No."
"Remorse for deeds done?"
"Yes."
I then explained to the spirit the conditions under which he lived, and the need to turn his thoughts away from worldly matters, which retarded spiritual progress. I begged him to cease to annoy innocent people, and I told him that he could only work out his own salvation by adapting his mind to the new conditions, by being unselfish, and by striving for higher things. I said that we would pray for him, and Mr. Vale Owen there and then offered up a beautiful prayer that this, our unhappy brother, might be eased and helped. I then asked if he had heard and understood.
"Yes,"
was the reply. Had it affected his attitude of mind? Some hesitation, and then,
"No."
Clearly he was a man of resolute character, not easily to be influenced. I then said that we would take any message from him and would like, first of all, to know his earth name. With that object, I gave him the alphabet slowly, asking him to move the table sharply on the right letter. The following letters came out: L E N A N. "Is that right?" I asked.
"No,"
was the reply. "Is L-E-N right?"
"Yes."
"Should the next letter be I?"
"Yes."
"Is Lenin the name?"
"Yes."
"Are you Lenin, the Russian leader?"
"Yes."
All our company protested that this man's name was not in the minds of anyone. Certainly it was, up to the last moment, unexpected by me. "Could you spell something in Russian?" was the next question.
"Yes,"
was the answer. Some lingual tests were then given, but I found it hard to follow them, for spelling out with the alphabet is hard work even in one's own tongue. The Dutch artist addressed the intelligence in several languages and received correct yes or no answers, which showed comprehension. "Have you a message for us?" I then asked.
"Yes,"
was the reply. "Then I will give you the alphabet." It was slow work, but this was the queer sentence which finally was hammered out. "Artists must rouse selfish nations." I thought that by artists he was using a shortcut to express the idea of all men of intelligence and imagination. We asked if this was the whole message and were told that it was not. As the alphabet procedure was so slow and clumsy, Mr. Horace Leaf suggested that we should put the table aside and sit in a circle and invite the spirit to control one or the other of us. Both Mr. Leaf and the artist volunteered to be the subjects of the experiment. We rearranged ourselves, therefore, and sang Lead Kindly Light for the sake of harmony and vibration. Suddenly, in the pitch darkness, a strange voice broke in on a low, level, clear tone. It was Mr. Leaf's own personal guide.
There is a spirit here who wishes to speak. He is a strong spirit. No, I would not say that he is an evil spirit. His aura is not evil. Yes, he is foreign. I could not say more than that.
The voice died away once more. Presently we heard gasps and short cries of pain. The spirit was endeavoring to possess Mr. Leaf. It was clearly ignorant of psychic things and did not know how to set about it. What it really did was to produce violent muscular contractions. Mr. Owen on one side and the doctor on the other had all they could do to hold his twisting, convulsed arms. Then, with a long sigh, he came back to consciousness. The attempt had been a failure, and a painful one. We were at a loss now how to proceed, and the table was reintroduced while the Dutchman took my place as questioner.
"The spirit is laughing,"
said the clairvoyant. She had, on other occasions, observed this sneering laugh. There is something slightly evidential here, for she had no recollection of Lenin's face as it was in life, but it may be recalled that he had a perpetual set contraction of his lips, which gave the impression of a broad smile, which was belied by his serious eyes. From our new attempts, we gathered that the rest of the message was an expression of the desire that Russia and Britain should be friends, with the warning that unless they could come to terms, they would drift into war, in which Russia would be very strong. And such was the whole message. Immediately it was given, the table turned dead, and we could obtain no further sign of intelligence. The clairvoyant reported the figure as sitting on the stairs for a time, and then passing on. So ended our curious experience in the old house in mid-London. It cannot be said that there was anything objective to which the senses of all of us could testify. On the other hand, it is certain that we were all in earnest, that there was no pressure on the table, that the messages were clear, and that the whole course of events was consistent. In answer to a question, the intelligence said that he had lived in London and that he had known these premises, though he had never actually lodged there. It may be added that it is a place frequented by foreign artists, with Russians among them, and that Lenin during his stay in London might well have been there. Mr. Vale Owen's feeling was that the visitor took it for granted that we were artists also, and that in his message artists is in the vocative. If he were mistaken about our vocation, it would prove that he was indeed external to ourselves. It was an appeal to us to rouse nations out of their selfishness, an appeal which could hardly come from an evil spirit. I am not sure of the doctor's conclusions, but I am convinced that everyone else in the company was convinced that we were in touch with a real entity, with a real message. And it is our hope that the message being delivered, the ghost of mid-London, will be heard of no more. Deception from the other side is an alternative and possible hypothesis. But we were all impressed by the extreme earnestness of this intelligence. And equally earnest were our own invocations to his honesty.
That was James Reeser reading The Ghost of the Moat and A London Ghost by Arthur Conan Doyle. It should be mentioned that, though Doyle remains to this day extremely popular as the creator of Sherlock Holmes, and his standing as an innovator in the mystery genre is by now quite secure, his adventures in spiritualism have done little to enhance his reputation as a thinker or intellectual. Even in his lifetime, several cases of the paranormal in which he took a personal interest were often debunked or exposed as frauds, perhaps most famously by his one-time friend, the magician Harry Houdini. All that being said, do make it a point, if you haven't already, to read and enjoy the 4 novels and 56 short stories that make up Doyle's Sherlock Holmes canon. You should also make that extra effort to obtain a copy of The Edge of the Unknown from your local library or bookstore. Older copies of the book don't pop up all that often, so be sure to grab one if you see it at a yard sale, flea market, or a used bookstore. Regardless of what side of this spiritualist argument you find yourself on, you're guaranteed a very enjoyable read. The Midnight Reading is produced by Gustavo Rodriguez and myself for Fireside Mystery Productions, with direction by Holly Payne Strange. Our audio engineers are Bill and Delaney Hafner. This series was recorded at the Silo Studios in Shirley, New York. It was written by Sylvan Sandovar. Our theme music is by Martina Da Silva. Don't miss upcoming installments of The Midnight Reading as well as recordings of our live show by subscribing to the Fireside Mystery Theater podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. A rating and review on iTunes would be most valued and appreciated. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is @FiresideMystery. Pick up some Fireside Mystery Theater swag on our merch page at FiresideMysteryTheater.com. And for those of you in the New York City area, mark your calendars. Fireside Mystery Theater returns to the stage for a brand new season of thrilling and chilling original radio drama. On Sunday, October 1st, 2017 at 2 p.m., we shall be at the Bickford Theater at the Morris Museum in Morristown, New Jersey, for a show we call Sing the Old Alma Mater. Tickets on sale soon at morrismuseum.org. This is Ali Silva, encouraging you to go out there and allow yourself to explore and discover the seductive allure of dark literature at your local bookstore or library. Thank you, kind listeners, for joining us. And until next time, be sure to mind the shadows.